Megan Feldman Betancourt is a journalist. She's originally from New Mexico, I believe, yes.
Yes, Albuquerque.
And she's covered major national stories that includes immigrants riding the train known as La Bestia through Mexico and also about Iraqi veterans. She's now an author, and her book, Triumph of the Heart, Forgiveness in an Unforgiving World, is an exploration of the concept of forgiveness. She explores the religious imperative behind this idea, as well as the neuroscience of forgiveness. The book ranges from her own journey to forgiveness in families to the international stage with a trip to Rwanda to explore how victims of genocide and mass rape could forgive their perpetrators. Megan will be speaking today at the Center for Spiritual Living in Albuquerque, which is on Louisiana just north of Manal. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Why did you want to focus on forgiveness?
You know, I didn't really. I've never particularly been interested in forgiveness. I'm not a very forgiving person by nature. I love grudges. I think they're really fun. And I actually did a magazine story about this man named Azim Kamisa, who not only forgave the man who killed his son, but reached out to the killer's family, and they became close friends, and they actually started a nonviolence education organization that does work with at-risk youth to prevent the kind of violence that killed his son. So when I did that story and I spent about a week with him in San Diego, I was just really struck by that. And I was struck especially by the fact that he seemed fulfilled, like truly. And meanwhile, I was going through kind of a rough period in my own life, and I was bitter over a breakup and over some professional disappointments. And I just had to know more. So I started to get into the research and just became really fascinated by it.
There's quite a bit of it. And, you know, your research indicates we're hardwired for both vengeance and forgiveness.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't realize it, but there's the fact that there is a large body of evidence, both for the fact that anger and resentment over time is really damaging, you know, to our brains, our hearts, our overall health, certainly our mood. And then on the flip side, that forgiveness is shown in multiple studies to have the opposite effects, that, you know, it enables us to be less at risk for heart problems, high blood pressure, mood problems like depression. And the evolutionary psychologists talk about how just that fact, that it is this coping mechanism that is positive as far as health, is evidence that it's an adapted trait that we've evolved with to help us survive, right? And so, yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Is it about not being angry?
You know, it's not. I actually, because as I said, I love anger, and I think righteous anger is really
helpful.
Important,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
There's this distinction I discovered between anger and bitterness, and Maya Angelou is someone who spoke really eloquently about this distinction, and she talked about how, you know, if you have to be angry, I mean, if you look at the world and you're not angry, she said, then you're a stone, but what do you do about that? You write it, you talk it, you paint it, you march it, you do everything about it. And yet you don't want to become bitter, because when you're not channeling anger productively, that's when you become resentful, you become bitter, and it doesn't prompt action like righteous anger does. And so that's when it becomes really toxic to our health. And it becomes, like Nelson Mandela said, a poison, you know, that resentment is a poison that you drink yourself, hoping that your enemy will die.
I know you use that in your TED Talk as well. It's a great image
to
think about.
Yeah,
you write about how seeking forgiveness and repairing harm helps us forgive ourselves. Why is that so important?
Yeah, it does. So to explore this notion of apology, I spent some time with a recovering alcoholic in suburban Arizona. And she had almost lost her entire family, you know, at the low point of her drinking. She had cheated on her husband and embarrassed her daughters on numerous occasions. And she was able to flesh out this whole idea of amends, which, you know, anyone who's ever done a 12-step program is familiar with. And the reason why they use the term amends,
making amends,
is because mm-hmm. as opposed to just lip service, which a lot of us associate with the word apology, amends is actually showing remorse and then changing your behavior and doing whatever you can to repair the harm. And so it just so happens that just as we expect other people to do that, you know, if they've made a mistake, if they've hurt us, we expect them to be remorseful and we expect them to change their behavior and redeem themselves. And the word redeem actually means to make better. So we expect that of ourselves too. And it turns out that, you know, if we have made some sort of mistake and hurt someone, if we don't try to make that right, it's very difficult to forgive ourselves.
I've seen that in people, namely my husband, if he's listening, people find it very hard to forgive themselves, who will forgive others, but hold on to never forgiving themselves.
It's true. I think some of the experts I spoke with, some of the psychologists who've done this research, talk about how it actually, for those of us who aren't sociopaths, which is the vast majority of us,
thank God.
it is more difficult to forgive ourselves than to forgive other people. Hmm. And I think that a lot of us have these really high standards that we hold ourselves to that we wouldn't hold, say, our best friend to at all.
Do you need to wait until someone apologizes to forgive? Like, you go into this in the book. It's really interesting.
Well, so it's certainly easier. It's easier to forgive someone who has apologized. And we know that from most of our experience as well as the research. But it turns out that you don't have to wait for an apology. And in fact, Azeem, the man I mentioned who started me off on the book, he talks about how if you're waiting on an apology, you're giving someone who's already hurt you power over your own well-being. And you're basically perpetuating your own victimization, which I think is a really good point. And it's not easy, but it's absolutely possible to forgive someone without an apology.
Sometimes you explored this, I think, in the trip to Rwanda and in other contexts. There's pressure to forgive prematurely.
Yes. So
talk about that.
Sure. In the most extreme examples, you know, we see situations where, for example, in Bolivia, there's a Mennonite colony, and there was years in which a group of males in the community were raping females, you know, as young as three. They were drugging them and raping them at night. And because this community is governed by men who are ministers, and the local Bolivian law enforcement has no sway over them, their response was, you know, to persuade these women that they should forgive, because if you don't forgive, God won't forgive you. And, you know,
well, I mean, taken to the ultimate extreme, yes, I guess you can argue that's a tenet of Christianity, but that sounds like a warped vision.
No, I would say that has nothing to do with forgiveness. Right. It has to do with you know, continuing to oppress people who've already been oppressed, and it has to do with persuading people not to report crimes and not to seek justice, which is not forgiveness. And in fact, the definition is to give up resentment. So you can certainly give up resentment and file charges. You can give up resentment and sue. That, you know, justice and forgiveness are not mutually exclusive. And I think that's a really important point. And when it comes to Rwanda, as you mentioned, there have been instances where the government or, you know, certain religious groups have pressured victims to forgive. And one of the psychologists I spoke with there who treats female survivors of sexual assault and mass rape during the genocide talks about that. And, you know, she talks about how everyone comes to forgiveness in her own time, and everyone has their own process. And that's true. And so I found these extraordinary stories where there was the seeking and granting of forgiveness in Rwanda. In particular, there's a village that I spent time in where a priest runs a 6-month, very in-depth program, and the perpetrators and the survivors come together, and there's a very in-depth process of redemption and forgiveness, and it's real. So both exist.
We have interviewed, I have interviewed, and other people have on this show, from the International Folk Art Market, a woman from Rwanda, Jana Unkabana, who created Gahaya Links Cooperative and brought together Tutsi and Hutu survivors. And it was intriguing because you talk about one of the ways people can find common ground is through collaboration out of mutual need. And that's kind of what she did, mm-hmm. because these women needed to survive and feed their families. So they make these amazing baskets. And now they sell them all over the world. But they come to the International Folk Art Market every year. But this kind of common self-interest sometimes seems to be a path to reconciliation.
Absolutely. And what was interesting to me is that there, you know, certainly this process of sharing testimonials and empathic listening, you know, which you see a lot of in truth and reconciliation programs, right, and processes, that absolutely did happen and does still happen in Rwanda and in other places, and it makes a huge difference. And what also makes a difference is, at the same time, enlisting people, you know, somehow creating efforts, whether it's companies or cooperatives or just having people work the fields together, some efforts that are mutually beneficial, where people of, you know, different groups that used to be antagonistic have to come together to accomplish something that they care about, because the divisions and the past kind of enmity does tend to fall away in the face of that. And we know that from a lot of really interesting social science research dating to the 50s even.
I was just struck by some of the women you interviewed in Rwanda, and men too, but their capacity to be able to move into that place of forgiveness was pretty extraordinary,
extraordinary. It is extraordinary. And, you know, for me, it's inspiring because I also write about everyday, more mundane issues that all of us deal with, right, that we can all relate to in the book, when it comes to the challenge of forgiveness and the benefit of it. But I think these more extreme examples, like Chantal, who is a woman I wrote about in the book, in Rwanda, who lost nearly her whole family. She survived a massacre of 3,000 people in 1994. And, you know, the fact that she has been able to heal from that and forgive and not be bitter and have this extraordinary quality of life, I think for me that's kind of a moral obligation that, okay, you know, that gives me perspective, and that's, I think, can inspire all of us.
She even forgave her uncle who decided to take her as his wife and rape her.
Yes.
After the genocide. Ugh.
She did, but didn't reconcile with him, which is important, right?
Okay.
She wrote him a letter, mm-hmm. She forgave him, and yet she wasn't interested in having him in her life. And I think that's one thing that, particularly when we talk about sexual assault, is important, that it doesn't, you know, if we forgive someone, it doesn't mean that we need to be buddy-buddy, and, you know, invite them to Thanksgiving dinner. We don't have to do that. There's a difference between forgiving and reconciling.
If you're just joining us, this is Women's Focus, and I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm talking with Megan Feldman-Betancourt about her book, Triumph of the Heart, Forgiveness in an Unforgiving World. She'll be speaking today and doing a book signing at the Center for Spiritual Living in Albuquerque at 2 o'clock. Megan, you also visited the Creativity for Peace Camp here in New Mexico. It brings Palestinian and Israeli girls together every summer. Was it possible for those girls in that short time to engage in forgiveness?
You know, I will say yes. And I want to say something about the word forgiveness when it comes to people who are involved in an ongoing conflict. It's a pretty touchy word. And it makes sense that it is, because this is something that's ongoing, right? And so what they at Creativity for Peace really focus on is a process of building understanding and mutual empathy among these girls. And that absolutely happens. And it's a key part of forgiveness. I think it makes it much more likely to be able to happen eventually. So on this individual level, they're becoming friends. I mean, there's this process of just storytelling, right? They tell their stories and they listen to each other. And one of the Israeli women, young woman who was attending when I was there, said to me, "I came here ready to shoot a fact like an arrow at any Arab. But I realized in talking with women from the other side that I had no idea what they were going through and what was happening on the other side." And so there are these stories of these girls becoming lifelong friends at this camp, which is challenging to maintain when they go back home, right?
You intersperse your research and your travels with your own stories of trying to forgive or trying to seek forgiveness. And it's like making amends, as you mentioned, in the 12-step program. Talk about the impact this had on you researching and writing the book, because you seem to go through a process yourself as you wrote it.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say as I went to all these places and profiled all of these people who have forgiven in very different circumstances, you know, extreme and everyday, I was collecting practices a little bit selfishly, you know? I mean, I wanted to.
Well, don't we all do that as journalists?
Right? Like, okay, so how do you do that? How does this work? And so for me, I did, and I have kind of adopted those as tools. And, you know, whether it's mindfulness, like just being in the present moment, and when I notice myself obsessing over something someone said to me or something I didn't do well enough, coming back to the moment without judging myself. I mean, that's one of the big things that I took away, but there's a lot of others. And it has helped me to be more compassionate with myself and with other people. And it's a work in progress, absolutely. But there certainly is a difference between the Megan who started out on this adventure and today's Megan. And I think particularly in my marriage, it's been really helpful. I was dating my husband Anthony when I started the book, and doing the chapter about the role of forgiveness in intimate relationships was great, because here I was digging into all this research, and it's been useful for me and for my relationship.
I confess, some of your self-examination was uncomfortable because I had similar tendencies, especially reacting when people didn't know something I thought they should know. When I was reading it, I was like, oh my God. So you actually went back and apologized to a lot of people. Was it painful to do this, to write this book? What was this like?
You know, partly, but it was also really healing as well. So you're talking about a friend of mine I had growing up in elementary school and middle school. And in sixth grade, what happened was I suddenly decided, for whatever reason, that she just wasn't cool enough. And I excluded her from our group of friends. And I was really mean. And this happened. It went on, I don't know how long, certainly for a few months. But I absolutely ruined our relationship, needless to say. And I had made a stab at apology in high school, but it was probably lame. I don't remember what I said, but it certainly wasn't very authentic or effective. And so, yeah, I reached out to her during the process of reporting the book, and had a really, for me, meaningful and moving exchange with her in the end.
Oh, you did. That's great. So that's something we can emulate.
Yes.
If we have the courage to do so.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You interviewed one researcher who does forgiveness training. What does that look like?
Yeah, so there's a number of researchers, actually psychologists, who have, you know, both implemented forgiveness clinically and studied the results of it with control groups. And I think you're probably referring to Fred Luskin, mm-hmm. from the Stanford Forgiveness Projects. And he's done trainings for, mediators here in the U.S. and women who've lost family members to the Troubles in Northern Ireland, all kinds of different groups. And he incorporates a lot of compassion work. So one example is an exercise he does called, like, Just Like Me. So you think about someone who has hurt you, or someone who you have trouble being around, and you just kind of do this visualization about, just like me, you know, he wants to be happy. Just like me, he's doing his best, et cetera. So he implements a lot of different things from different areas of psychology and even physiology.
On an individual, sort of a intimate level, but also like a global political level,
right?
Kind of work,
right? And he would employ, I mean, with the groups of people who come from formerly warring nations, for example, he employs that kind of empathic listening and storytelling model as well.
You referenced earlier about the neuroscience behind forgiveness. There was a lot of research going on around this, which is interesting. So what kind of chemicals are flooding your body when you're in revenge mode or anger mode?
Yeah, so basically when we react in anger and rage, we're flooded with adrenaline, cortisol, other stress hormones that really are activating the amygdala, like what's the part of the brain that's activated, I should say.
The fight or flight.
Is the amygdala, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, it's very old, it's ancient, it's fight or flight, it's survival mode, as opposed to the frontal lobe, the newer parts of our brain, which are responsible for problem solving and also empathy. And just what's interesting is that as opposed to the fight or flight response, when your capacity for problem solving is really compromised, just the act of contemplating whether or not someone merits forgiveness engages these more modern parts of our brains that are engaged with, say, empathy and, you know, being able to solve a problem based on logic.
That is so interesting. So basically they put people in scanners, MRIs, or,
yes, uh-huh,
and
the
watch
fMRI
different
scanners.
Reactions to,
yes,
scenarios.
Exactly.
They put on. So does forgiveness mean that you must love your enemy?
You know, I thought about that a lot. And for me, that's kind of tied into this question about reconciliation, right? And in the end, I had two conclusions. And one is that there are levels of forgiveness. There, you know, everything from this basic, you do it as a gift for yourself so that you can be healthy and happy and move on, to the man in Rwanda who I interviewed who adopted the children of the man who murdered his mother. Okay, that's a spectrum. And so there are different levels. Just like the Jewish philosopher Maimonides talked about levels of giving, there's levels of forgiving. And when it comes to love, I think a lot about agape, that kind of, you know, the Greek concept of love for humankind, not familial, not romantic, but just this very basic human respect. And so I think when you forgive, whether or not you end up continuing that relationship, whether or not you love that person, meaning that you want to, you know, be married to them or have them in your family, you can absolutely love them in that agape type of way.
And if you're joining us on Women's Focus, I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with another Megan, Megan Feldman Betancourt. She's a journalist. She's an author now with her first book out, Triumph of the Heart, Forgiveness in an Unforgiving World. She'll be speaking today at the Center for Spiritual Living in Albuquerque at 2 o'clock. Megan, what's the relationship between gratitude and forgiveness?
So it turns out that both forgiveness and gratitude are a lot about what we focus on. When we don't forgive someone, when we're angry at someone over time, basically it leads us to kind of be in this obsessional mode, obsessing over something that happened in the past or whatever they did to us. And when we're feeling really bad about our lives in the present and we're focused on what's not working, that's the opposite of gratitude. So as it turns out, it's really focusing on what is working. And in the case of forgiveness, interestingly, I just want to point out a quick example about this. A lot of the people I interviewed for the chapter on forgiving parents experienced something pretty extraordinary that they told me about. And it was a number of people where they would, after they forgave a parent, they suddenly would have all of these memories that were very positive about that parent, things they hadn't thought about in years or even decades. And so that's pretty powerful, because that enables you to focus on something more positive in the past, as opposed to just, you know, what was really damaging.
I mean, that's hard. Some of the people you interviewed had pretty horrific traumas from their parents.
Yeah, some of them did. Yeah. And others were very kind of common, you know, dealing with absentee dads, right? Or kind of basic neglect, or parents who had illnesses that compromised their ability to parent. So yeah, there's the whole gamut in, mm-hmm, there. And what was interesting was that everyone kind of alluded to this experience of being able to be more grateful, you know, after having gone through that process.
When you did your TED Talk on this topic at the TED Boulder event, you were pregnant and you have one child?
I do, now. Yes. Yep, he's now 7 months old.
What kind of impact has that had on you in the context of this work?
Well, the first thing is self-compassion becomes much more crucial, I think, when you're a parent, because it's so easy to constantly criticize yourself. And I know other moms know what I'm talking about, probably other dads too, where it's just, you know, you want to be perfect for them and you want to do everything perfectly, and yet you can't. And so being able to be patient with yourself and kind to yourself becomes really important. And I'm a perfectionist, and so that's not natural to me. So that's one thing that's been helpful as a reminder. And then the other thing is just I feel like it's more of an imperative than ever that we find a way to implement the seeking and granting of forgiveness in our communities, schools, and countries. Because frankly, you know, I'm interested in my son growing up in a world that's a bit different from the one we have now.
And you want to go back to Azim, who we started with, and who started you on this journey, who forgave his son's killer. What about the boy you shot? His son, is he still in jail or in prison?
He's still in prison. Yep, I believe he's still in Corcoran State Prison in California. And the earliest he would be released would be 2020.
Does Azeem still go see him?
He does, to my knowledge. I know they write. They definitely correspond.
And he formed this foundation with the boy's grandfather.
Grandfather, yes. Plus Felix. Yes, so it's called the Tariq Kamisa Foundation. And they do assembly programs in at-risk middle schools in San Diego, but also around the country. And they've reached, I think, at least 8 million young people at this point.
Well, Megan, I want to thank you for coming and talking with us on Women's Focus.
Thank you so much, Megan. It was my pleasure.
Megan Feldman Betancourt is the author of Triumph of the Heart, Forgiveness in an Unforgiving World. And she will be speaking today in Albuquerque and doing a book signing at the Center for Spiritual Living at 2 o'clock. It's on Louisiana. I think it's just north of Manal.